Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hagan. I'm working at
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Welcome to the Chuck and Julie Show. This is Mark Poff, guest hosting forum. It's July 28th, 2025. Hopefully, Chuck and Julie are out having a good time with their kid Rev, playing golf, hopefully in a tournament, or having fun doing something. I do love to come in and guest host every once in a while, just to give them time off. They need to be able to take some time off. I love the Chuck and Julie Show. Hope you guys can join all the time and listen to Chuck and Julie, all the great stuff about politics in the state of Colorado. They provide a service that very few podcasts do, which is keeping you enlightened about the politics, the local politics or state politics here in Colorado. So normally I have John with me, but unfortunately this morning, John told me he had to quickly drive up to Denver to do some surveillance. So as you know, John and I, we still do consulting and stuff and a lot of judicial stuff. So, and I really would want you to encourage you to call in, or just if you're on, just watching on Zoom, just to put your hand up. Hopefully I'll catch it, or just start talking is fine. If you want to call in, it's 888-627-6008. Feel free to call in and we can chat about whatever you want to chat about. So I'm going to spend the first 15, 20 minutes talking about kind of the current events and stuff that are going on, which is what I like to do. And then I want to talk about something in law enforcement that's somewhat unique. Normally, like I said, John and I were detectives for many years. He was the commander of investigations, and he headed up hundreds of criminal investigations, homicides, hundreds of homicides. And I worked for him as a detective, working on numerous homicides and other criminal cases. So that's really where our expertise is. But I do like to spend a little bit of time. And some people have said, you know, hey, I really don't care what you have to say about politics. That's cool. This just gives me an opportunity to get some things off of my chest about things that I find entertaining in politics. And then I'm going to move on and talk about an interesting part of my career years ago when I actually worked in the jail. I want to talk about something that I think you'll find interesting about that, that the state of Colorado is kind of really screwed up. So today I'd love to talk about the Russiagate investigation, or the, you know, Russia. And now it's all kind of backfired on them. I'm very interested in this. I'm interested about why the stuff is being released now, even though I don't really care. It's like, hey, whenever it gets out, it gets out. And let's look at the actual documents. You know, if somebody says these are forged documents or they're not accurate, then that's interesting. You know, but if they are true documents, and former President Obama, along with his cabal of leadership, didn't like the fact how the election came out. And so they attempted, or I wouldn't say they attempted, they did get a narrative out there that really jammed up Trump and his administration. Now, I think Trump learned from that. And this administration is just, wow, hold on for the ride. I mean, it's like a bullet train of stuff that's going on. Even after 6-7 months, it's like this train's really moving fast. And maybe that's because of what happened during his first term and the lessons learned. But I'm sure that Chuck and Julie will talk about the Russiagate investigation during their segments coming up. But I'd love to hear everything they have to say about that, but it's a little too soon. But something that happened, I think it happened today, was, if you know a guy named Jim Cramer, he works for CNBC. He's supposed to be like a financial analyst, or, you know, an expert in stocks. And he has a show called Mad Money. And I think there's a couple others that he's on. And he talks about investments and the economy and all kinds of stuff. I used to listen to him or watch him back, I think, years ago. And to be honest with you, as a investor, I found his advice to be terrible. I think he's kind of an idiot and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He tries to have a very entertaining show, but I really don't think he's that knowledgeable. Well, today he dropped an F-bomb on live TV. Well, that appears to be the Democrat thing to do. I don't know if he's a Democrat or not, probably, but right in the middle of CNBC, he drops an F-bomb and he's that surprised that, I mean, it's a slip. It's obviously a slip. You've got to go watch the video, go out to Fox News or go Google Jim Cramer drops F-bomb on live TV and watch the video of when he drops this F-bomb. It's like he's so surprised he can't help himself. So obviously dropping F-bombs for Mr. Cramer is not a problem for him. He's used to doing it so much. That it slips out. And occasionally you see it on the five, and I always start laughing to hear live Dana Perino drop the S bomb was pretty funny. And she was pretty embarrassed. But he says this, he apologizes immediately. But the question is, why did he slip an F bomb? I mean, he did not mean to. I mean, it just came out. They were talking about tariffs, and they're trying to, and this is my opinion, trying to explain that tariffs are having a bad impact on the world economy, that tariffs are impacting people and causing all kinds of problems. Well, are they? I don't know that a tariff has impacted me at all. I wouldn't know. So it's not anything that I'm like, whoa, what happened there? Is that a tariff that I am I now buying a product that got hit with a large tariff? And I haven't noticed anything with my shopping other than my gas prices have come down and other products like eggs have really come down, but I think that was going to happen anyway. So have tariffs really impacted the world economy? But that's not what got him to drop an F-bomb. He was trying to talk, oh yeah, it's definitely impacting the economy. And then someone else said, well, I think, part of the problem may be that the feds won't drop rates. And then here comes the F-bomb. Well, why at that point does Cramer drop an F-bomb? Like, holy crap, what, and I think that he's saying this, I mean, my opinion is that the reason Cramer lost it is it's Trump derangement syndrome. Trump has been saying for a long time that the feds need to lower the interest rates. Well, Cramer, after he drops the F-bomb, he actually says the interest rates are fine. They're fine. The economy's doing well. Well, wait a minute. You were just arguing that the tariffs were impacting the world economy, and now you just dropped an F-bomb, quickly turned around and said, there's no reason for the feds to drop the interest rates. Well, we know the feds should drop the interest rate. We know that the lack of the feds dropping the interest rate is what is really keeping the economy from taking off. So what is Cramer's real goal? If his goal on CNBC is to help investors to make money, then he should want all these stocks to go up. So let's do a little review. So when all this tariff stuff came out, when Trump said, hey, we're going to do 30%, when he had that list and stuff, and then he said, you know what, I'm going to give him a time to negotiate. So let's set everything at 15 or whatever it was, or 10. But all the markets crashed. I say crashed. They went down pretty heavily, and then they just started rebounding. And in fact, I think three of the four major indicators are higher now than they were back when these tariffs were announced. But it wasn't the actual implementation of the tariffs that made the market go down. It was all the overreaction of the tariffs that it's going to affect the world economy, that this is going to cause all kinds of problems. And then after the next few weeks, everyone realized there really was nothing going on. And really, this was a negotiation ploy by Trump to get every of the other nations to come talk to us about tariffs. So really, the tariffs haven't impacted us. So why, if Cramer's trying to help the market, why is he trying to sell to everybody that the tariffs are impacting the world economy? Well, okay, maybe they are impacting the world economy because they're making the world come to Trump and negotiate. And that's what's happening. And they're realizing very quickly, if you're not one of the first countries, you may not get the best deals. So really, the tariffs have done a wonderful thing for the country. Long term, this could be very interesting to watch to see what the outcome of all these tariff negotiations and negotiations with all these countries. But Cramer is trying to sell this, and then he says, no, the economy's doing fine. Well, wait a minute, tariffs are bad, but you're saying we're doing great or whatever. Fabulous, I think, was his words. Why would he be concerned about the interest rates going down? Is it because they don't want Trump to be successful? So they'd just rather hold the whole country up from great success. Just think about everybody's 401ks and their retirement plans. And what about first-time home buyers that need lower interest rates so they can buy homes? So all these good things that would obviously come from lower interest rates. But yet Cramer drops an F-bomb on national TV on CNBC with the mere thought of it would be a good idea to lower interest rates, which we know would have a tremendous effect on the economy. Right now, the housing market is kind of becoming a little stagnant because of the higher interest rates. And Trump's suggesting 3 points. Now, obviously, you don't want to do something like that, but ultimately, it should be between 1.5, 2.5%. But why is he such against that? And I'm going to get back to him here in a few minutes about Jerome Powell and talking about him directly. But the tariffs did not cause any major issues or problems with the world economy or anything like that. This is how I kind of reflect on these tariffs. I used to be a manager at MCI, telecommunications company, and back in the late 90s. So I was hired to work for MCI, and during the Y2K panic, if you want to call it a panic. So during the Y2K, we all kind of got in this panic that, oh, this is going to be a huge thing on the year 2000. So I had to work that night, the night of going into January 1st of 2000 to make sure all our code worked and we didn't have issues with our phone system. So nothing happened. I remember they had these cool glasses, and I still have some of them upstairs. That's something to the effect of, I survived Y2K. But not much really happened. But there was all that panic leading up to that the Russian nukes were all going to self-launch and all kinds of this huge stuff. And this is all kind of around the whole thing about the tariffs. Was all this panic that, oh, if you implement these tariffs, everything's going to go to hell. Well, nothing really happened. So it's just like Y2K. So nothing happened. There's no panic, no reason to panic at all. So they got to come up with something. The Democrats have got to come up with something. And so that's why they're going after Epstein, this whole thing about Epstein. I mean, I look at this from a law enforcement standpoint, and Epstein really doesn't mean much to me. How many people commit suicide in jails? A lot. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't something that happened. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that for me, the Epstein thing is just really, is there a client list? I don't know. Would I like to see it? Sure. I got news for you. Bill Clinton's name's on the top of it. So if there's someone who kept or is trying to keep this out of the limelight, it's probably the Clintons because he went to the island, is my understanding. So, but why are they really pushing this Epstein thing? It's interesting. I have to admit, it is interesting. I'm interested to hear what Maxwell has to say, what she can bring to the table. That might be entertaining to me. But why is it that they want to focus on Epstein so much? I mean, I watch all the shows like Meet the Press and all that on Sunday mornings because I find them interesting. And they all wanted to talk about Epstein. That, hey, this is a big deal. Don't let it die. Don't let it die. Why? Why is this such a big deal? There's so many things more interesting to talk about. Well, let me tell you why they don't want to talk, or why they want to talk about Epstein is because they don't want to talk about immigration, border inflation, tariffs, trade, energy, stock market, taxes, or Russiagate. So that's all they got. All the other stuff, Trump is just absolutely freaking crushing it. Now, and I've said this before, I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump. When he speaks, I don't find it energizing. I actually find JD Vance to be a better speaker, and I like to listen to other because Trump constantly repeats himself and stuff. So, but his administration is just freaking kicking it. I just love everything that's going on with the Trump administration. So they want to talk about the stuff that is meaningless. It's really just not a big picture stuff. I'm not that interested in Epstein. Trump is cutting deals everywhere, and the economy is doing well. And it's only been 6 months. So, I mean, these are all really cool things. So, here's kind of what happened today that I find very interesting. So, Trump's in Scotland talking with the prime minister and stuff. And I did find that conversation a little interesting this morning. So, here's the whole deal with the EU. I find the whole EU very entertaining, and I think it's going to collapse. And here's why. And it may be because of these tariffs. I mean, the tariff negotiations with the United States could be the beginning of the end of the EU. And here's why. So Brexit, the British exited EU. They voted on it, got the hell out. England's not part of the EU, but yet they negotiated. Now, England by itself is smaller than the EU. Obviously, EU's like 20 some nations, France, Germany, some pretty major Italy, major countries, and a lot of smaller ones. So the whole theory is we can negotiate better as a team. You know, we can control the financial, monetary stuff. We can do things so much better with the European Union than these little states can or countries by themselves. But England, who came to the United States and said, yeah, let's negotiate a new tariff deal, they got 10% basic. Now, there's some other things about parts and Rolls-Royce engines and specialty stuff that have no tariffs and other things like that. But the base value of tariffs between the US and England is 10%. So here's the EU comes in today and they announced that they negotiated a 15%, 50% more. You know, not 10%, 15% basic tariff. Well, that's not a good deal for them. They need 10%, same as England. We're the EU. We should get the same rate as England. Well, they didn't negotiate that. And that's one of the major problems. Who negotiates for the EU? Well, it's a negotiator negotiates for all of them. Well, don't you think the needs of Denmark or whoever, hopefully that's a member of the EU, Belgium, whatever, that their needs and their trades with the US is totally different than like Germany. Germany and Italy, mainly Germany, is a major automotive industry. And so is England and so is Italy. Don't you think Germany would like to negotiate a better deal with the US than 15%? Now, look what they also think. I wrote it down here because it's so interesting. So one of the problems was is they had a pretty good tariff on American cars, just to talk about the automotive industry. But in this deal, man, I wrote it down here. So yeah, US made vehicles had a 10% tariff. It's going down to 2.5%. Wait a minute, I thought the EU's with America is 15%. That's correct. So now the tariff of EU made cars, we're talking Germany, Italy, all are going to have a 15% tariff, but American cars coming into the EU, into Europe, are going to have a 2.5% tariff. Well, that's a hell of a negotiation, guys. Wish I could cut a deal like that if I was America. So is Germany going to be like, what the frick? So as of whenever this kicks in, who's the winner and who's the losers? Well, the winner is going to be Jaguar, right? Or Land Rovers or whatever, Bentleys, Rolls-Royces, especially their aircraft engines. But so you have BMW, Volkswagen, Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, Audi. What about Maseratis, Lamborghini, and Ferraris, the cars that I typically buy? They're all going to have a 15% tariff, but our cars going in are now going to have 2.5. So this is the deal that the EU negotiated. Was it better than England? Not even close. So a country like Germany is going to go, the hell with you guys. You know, we're going to go negotiate our own. And so I think this actually could be the beginning of the end. So this is already what I want to say, what the French prime minister had to say about the trade deal that EU just negotiated with the United States. This is what she said. It is a dark day when an alliance of free peoples brought together to affirm their common values and to defend their common interests resigns itself to submission. So that's the term that they're saying. And another term that's being said is it's the least bad option. And then the negotiator, one of the negotiators for this, the EU Trade Commissioner, said, this is clearly the best deal we could get under very difficult circumstances. Why was it difficult circumstances to negotiate a tariff deal with the United States? You're the EU. You're huge. You're a whole conglomeration of countries all negotiating together with all your power, and you negotiate a worse deal than England got. Why is that? I think, like I said, I think this could be the beginning of the end of the EU, because I think some countries are going to be like, we can do a better deal by ourselves. We don't need the EU. They're just, they're not going to like the deal and just wait over time. They're not going to like it, and they're going to try to negotiate their own deals. France, Italy, Germany, they're all going to say, wait a minute, I get we're the member of the EU, but we want to negotiate separate trade deals. So let's see what happens. So I found that very interesting today. So how do we solve the problem with the Federal Reserve? Trump wants to fire Jerome Powell. And I found it very entertaining last week. I think it was Friday when Trump went over to do the site survey of the new remodeling of the Fed Reserve building and pull that piece of paper. That was a complete setup by Trump. I love it. I found it entertaining because $3 billion, someone said that you could build a skyscraper in New York City for $3 billion. How much of a building could you have built in Colorado Springs for that kind of money? So we could have moved the whole Federal Reserve to Kansas City. Not that I'd want to go to Kansas City. Put it right in the middle of the nation. So, why does the Federal Reserve have to be in Washington, D.C.? All of these properties are extremely overpriced. Why don't you just move them somebody else, somewhere else, and then, and then here, just hold on one second. John's saying that he wants to jump on here in a few minutes, and we'll see what we can talk about here about law enforcement stuff. So how to solve the problem with Jerome Powell? Well, one, you could move it. But here's the key. I use this old term. Why is divorce so expensive? Why is it expensive to get a divorce? Quite simply, it's because it's worth it. Well, that's how I feel about Jerome Powell. Trump wants him out. He doesn't want to leave. So make it a divorce. Don't fire him. I don't think you need to fire him. Already appoint his replacement. Do it now or do it in November. Say, here's the guy that I'm going to nominate as his replacement next May. Start the whole Senate confirmation if you want. I don't know if you can do that or not. Give him a special title, future, chairperson or whatever. And then move a desk. Who controls Jerome Powell's building? Is it controlled by the federal government? Does ultimately Donald Trump control that building? I don't know. But what I would do is I would say, I want this new person to be in on every meeting. I want this guy to be in every meeting. So wherever Jerome Powell goes, I want my new guy so you can train him in the next 6 months. Every meeting you're in, every phone call you're in, I'd move a desk into his and then say, here's where he's going to sit in your office next to you. And just make this guy be his little, whatever you want to call it. Give him a special title like Doge or whatever, and then do this. And one of the things I was thinking about is in the old days, the sheriff, the local county sheriff, used to control the courthouse. So when judges were doing things the sheriff didn't like, I saw this in a movie, so I think it would be kind of interesting. He moved the judge's office into a bathroom. So just start making Jerome Powell's life so miserable that he resigns and gets out. But I think it'd be great to have a new person in there. Just put them in now, make them the assistant too, or whatever. Appoint them and say, this guy's going to be your shadow for the next 6 months. He'll resign. I guarantee it. He'll be fed up, and he'll get out of there. But Jerome Powell needs to leave because he's obviously making decisions that are politically based. You know, because everybody's saying yes, the interest rates should start coming down, and the ones who don't want it to come down are the ones that don't want to see the market take off. So that's my stuff. Sorry about that. I know some people have said, "Hey, I don't really care what you have to say about politics," and that's cool. But I get it. But it gives me an opportunity to just, as an individual, you know, to kind of get out there the things that kind of I find entertaining in politics. But now I want to talk to you about something I think is really interesting. Until John can pop on, and then I doubt he'll have anything to say about this. I don't know if some of you know this. Some probably do, some don't. So the ICE, immigration control enforcement, back in 2000 or in 1996, came up with this program. It's called the 287G program. They always come up with numbers. So the goal of this program was to get local law enforcement, mainly deputy sheriffs working at jails, to help ICE with deporting illegal aliens. And so what they did back in 96 is, and they do it all the time now, like Homeland Security has task forces, FBI has the TFF, whatever the joint terrorist organization, where you have local law enforcement that, in conjunction with federal agents, work to help on a federal goal. So while you're a local law enforcement officer, you can also help with federal goals. And so with ICE, it's obviously the deportation of illegal aliens. So they created this program in the jails. And so there was a whole very stringent thing that you had to jump through to be able to be a member of, it's not a task force, of this program, the 287G program. And I think there was actually some money involved. So what you would do is these local deputies working at the jail would go to training from ICE, and they would get access to a federal system. So they'd be kind of like a task force member. So they'd probably even be sworn in as a federal agent, and you would have them on site at the jail working in intake and release, and they would help ICE agents. So in the old days, it was really up to the jail to contact ICE and say, "Hey, we got some people here that were arrested for a criminal act." I mean, that's the only way you get into jail typically, is you get arrested for a criminal act unless some federal agency wants to leave somebody there overnight or something while they're transporting. But you come into the jail, you got arrested, you committed a felony or a misdemeanor. Typically now it'd have to be a felony. And they're like, "Man, I think their immigration status is questionable here. They don't speak no English." So you'd have to contact ICE and said, "Hey, you may want to check into this guy." Well, that's not very efficient. So with the 287G program, you allowed the local deputies in intake and release to actually get on the system and check their immigration status. And if they could confirm that there was either a detainer or a deportation order already in effect, which means that they already had their time in court. You know, they've already been in front of a judge and there is a deportation order, or whether it's a judge or a hearing officer or whatever, but there is a deportation order, in fact. They could then notify ICE that the jail has them. They could keep them in the jail, and then they could come pick them up. Now, obviously, if they're there for criminal offenses, that has to be worked out first. But the bottom line is that you could have local deputies doing this. It made it very efficient. So ICE would get notified that these people are coming in and that they could hold them and deport them. This was very effective. So who doesn't like that? Who doesn't like the fact that this program using local individuals or local deputies to do that, it works great. Well, the Democrats don't like that. They don't like the fact that it worked great. And so a lot of these states, they're basically were states were starting to sign up for this, and then the Democrats figured it out, and so they started trying to shut it down. I didn't even realize this, that Joe Biden, when he ran for president, he promised that if he was elected, he'd get rid of the program. He'd get rid of it. Why would you get rid of a program that helps you more effectively deport individuals that already have deportation orders that have been booked into a jail for a criminal offense. These are exactly the people that you want to deport and get out of our country. And they all say that, oh yeah, if they commit a felony, we should get them out of the country. Well, then explain to me why would they want to shut down a program that makes that so much effective? In June of 2021, there was 146 agencies nationwide in 25 states that were signed up for this, that were helping ICE out and saying, we've got your guy, come get him. And here in Colorado, and I know this because I worked in the jail back in that time. I worked very briefly for like 8 months, I want to say in 2003, late three going into 2004, because I worked for a sheriff's office and they wanted everybody to spend a little time in the jail. So I worked there and I knew about this. So Biden promised that he'd shut it down, but he didn't shut it down, but it started going away. So Colorado was doing this. El Paso County, Teller County, were all members of this process. So what did Colorado do? We know Colorado's a blue state. We got Governor Polis. So they got rid of it. They made it illegal in 2023 for local agencies to work with ICE and do this, the 287G program, to be more effective in getting rid of individuals that are arrested on felonies that had deportation orders. So right now, there's no county sheriffs in Colorado that can do this because of this law in 2023. So what states do this and what states don't? Now, as soon as Trump got elected, he went back in and he set it up and he did an executive order really promoting that, hey, let's get this 287, is a great thing. So now we have 166 agencies in 40 states that are members of the 287G program and helping ICE when these illegals get arrested and are booked into the jail to let ICE know that we have them, that there is a deportation order, you need to come pick them up. But there's, I believe, six states that have outlawed working with ICE. They've actually outlawed it or they have policies against it. Guess what states they are? You know them. California, Oregon, Washington, Illinois, New Jersey, and Colorado. All these blue states, six blue states, have outlawed local county sheriffs on working with ICE to help a speedy deportation of illegal aliens that are arrested for felonies. The exact people that we say we want to get rid of. Hey, so John did join us for the last few minutes here. Well, I guess we got more time than that. It's only 3:33. I haven't bored everyone with all that stuff. I just wanted everyone to know that Colorado has actually outlawed the county sheriffs and jails helping to deport felons, basically. So John, if you could bring them up here in Spotlight, and this is what's going to make this really interesting, is John and I have nothing to talk about. We haven't negotiated ahead of time what it is we're going to talk about. So I wrote something down here real quick. Originally, I thought we'd talk about cell phone forensics, but one of the questions that's been asked of both of us, and I don't think we've talked about this, and if we have, I apologize, and I'm sure we'll switch subjects quickly, is why did John and I abandon our law enforcement careers to go out on our own, kind of in a partnership, but not really? We are partners, but there is no contracts. We work together on a lot of projects. We have a great time working together. We don't always agree on things, which is actually an awesome thing to have. Two people that agree on everything, you might as well just have one. So we have some very lively debates about things. But why did we, if John, if you're comfortable talking about this, because I rem do you actually remember where we had the conversation and when?
I don't, but I can tell you why I left law enforcement.
I understand that, but we actually did it at a Trevelli's restaurant up on the north side of town, which has since closed. Trevelli's does have a drive-through to give Trevelli's a little
Shout out.
business here. And yeah, shout out here in Colorado Springs. If you want the best Phillies, now I do like Taste of Philly over on the west side of Colorado. We go there probably about 2 or 3 times a month. They make a great Philly. But Trevelli's has always been the place to get Phillies here in Colorado Springs. We were sitting in their restaurant that they opened, and we just started talking about, our time in law enforcement and kind of the whole thought of what would it be like if we went out on our own and became consultants? Could we be successful? And I don't think we really knew if we were going to be successful, but I think we were pretty confident because there was nobody in the state of Colorado that was providing the knowledge that we knew, especially about technology, to defense attorneys. So,
Right.
I mean, but if you want to address, I know why I wanted to get out. I thought I'd been there long enough, and I was just really excited about the whole idea of having been a detective for 10 years, switching over and working for defense attorneys. I just thought that would be entertaining. But if you want to address that, here's your opportunity.
Sure. So, actually, I'm probably the one that wasn't as excited. You kind of work your way through the ranks. You hope at some point you can become a supervisor, work your way up maybe to a lieutenant if you're lucky, and then if you're really lucky, you can work your way up to commander. And at the time, I was a commander. So, what was it, 2014 when you and I had this discussion? I was still about 7 years away from retirement, and with retiring as a commander, there's a lot of perks involved in that. So it would have to take, have to be something pretty drastic in order for you to want to leave law enforcement 7 years away from retirement. And the reason why I left was, the eventual sheriff who was going to be coming into play, and what I knew of him
Idiot.
was, well, corruption and
I'll say it. Most corrupt sheriff ever in the state of Colorado, Bill Elder. That is my opinion.
I mean, and so, there was already some word out that I was going to be working my way backwards, that I was going to be probably sent to the jail as a deputy or a sergeant, and I didn't work my whole life, trying to work backwards. So for those of you that don't know the rank structure, law enforcement's very much like a paramilitary organization. So you have your deputy, your senior deputy, your sergeant, your lieutenant, and then your commander. And above the commander is, in our office, it was a bureau chief, and a bureau chief answered to an under sheriff who answered to the sheriff. So, as the commander, Mark, I had what, 53 people, I think, that worked underneath me that I was responsible for. So, you think, okay, I could ride out into the sunset, essentially, 7 years, I can, do my time and get out and then have a retirement. And when Elder ended up winning the election, that changed all my plans, and that's the horrible part of working in county government, is that if you work at the pleasure of the sheriff, they can essentially get rid of you at any time if for, essentially no cause, right? It's at the pleasure of the sheriff. So I wasn't willing to risk it, And so, yeah, you and I had this conversation and we talked about it, and it made sense that, it was about time to move on, because I wasn't interested in going backwards. But I will tell you, I mean, the problem with going into consulting, Mark, and I don't know if you experienced this, but when you work in law enforcement, it's kind of your identity. You're associated with law enforcement, right? Everybody that knows you, in that law enforcement community, you're kind of that family of law enforcement that you kind of look out for one another. At least you think that, right? And so it was tough for me to leave, a family that I've been involved in for 17 years, to just all of a sudden pick up, without anything to show for it. And so, because you have to serve out your time in order for you to get your retirement. And I unfortunately wasn't able to work for the next sheriff. And so, that's when the real serious talks happened with you and me about trying to move on to something else. And I will tell you, there's as much reward for me, putting somebody behind bars that is involved in some crime, as it is in helping somebody who's been wrongfully accused.
Oh, actually, I'm sorry for interrupting,
No,
John,
it's okay.
but I would tell you, And I'm going to use another analogy. I was a big baseball player when I was younger. And you can do the same analogy for football. In baseball, you could really like hitting home runs, or you could like or love making a catch at the wall or making an awesome play. In football, some people would love to be the quarterback or be a wide receiver, but others like, no, I want to be a linebacker. I want to freaking kill somebody. So to me, it's kind of like that same analogy about whether working in law enforcement or working for the defense. And I have to tell you, having been in law enforcement, and I think you and I would both agree on this, I loved putting people in prison. Now,
That did
not
that.
because it's, but
Absolutely.
it's not because I want to put a person in prison. I want to put a bad guy. Ron Stanley is the guy that I'll never forget his name ever. He was raping his granddaughter, and I got 21 years to life for this guy. He died in prison of COVID, probably one of the only few good things that happened with COVID. I was so proud to put that guy in prison for what he had done. But then you talk about the other side. Here's someone who's completely falsely accused. This person committed no crime, and the cops and the DA's office are completely in confirmational bias. And we've seen this. I've seen this working for law enforcement as a detective, and I've definitely seen it as a consultant working for defense attorneys, where they're like, I know that bastard's guilty, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to put them in jail. And it's like, that guy didn't do anything. You just don't like him. So sorry for interrupting, because you're saying that, but I have to tell you personally, I'm taking as much, I don't think of the word enjoyment, satisfaction. I'm taking as much satisfaction, if not more, working for the defense as a prior cop, wanting to do it right. And we both are completely law enforcement friendly. We both support law enforcement completely. My daughter's a detective. I love that she's a detective. I'm so proud of her. And so we want law enforcement to be successful. We want them to put bad guys in prison, but we want to be able to keep innocent people out of the system and out of jail and out of prison.
And I can speak from personal experience, Mark. I think the worst part of being accused of something you didn't do is, what people don't understand is that, it only takes one time. It only takes one time
Your life's ruined.
for something to get out, right? And then the press gets wind of it, right? And it makes for a juicy story. And of course, right, when you're exonerated, the juicy story does not, there's no, you don't, you'd be lucky to get a sentence or two in the news about how, that you were wrongfully accused. And so, what I don't think is really, and I can tell you when I was in law enforcement, it really didn't resonate with me until I started doing more work on both sides. And that was that it's very hard in law enforcement to understand the impact of your actions on somebody's life. Right, they think that when you make an arrest, oh, you know what, if you didn't do it, there's a trial for you, and you can work out the trial, and if you're really innocent, right, the jury will find you innocent. And that is the farthest thing from the truth. What they don't understand is it's not just the financial. I mean, this is not the time to have a beer budget, right? You got to get a good
Right.
attorney, and good attorneys cost a lot of money, which is why a lot of people. People always, they don't understand why people take plea deals when, when a crime has been committed or an allegation of a crime being committed, why they take a plea. And what we find out is the reason why a lot of people take pleas is the alternative is not an option they're willing to consider. Just give you an example, right? How many times have we worked cases where somebody is accusing somebody of a sexual allegation? And think about that, Mark. In this world, you and I are a finger snap away from somebody making an allegation. And the reality is we may have never been in contact with that person, but an arrest could happen. And the mere allegation of a sex assault, right? I mean, think about it.
It's huge.
It's huge. I mean, it's life altering. It's anything that you thought you would be able to do as a professional will now be gone because the stigma of you being associated with some kind of sexual allegation is horrendous. You know, think of the number of teachers and the people, you know, professionals that deal with this, you know, on a regular basis. I mean, how many times have you and I worked cases involving somebody, an educator, being, you know, accused of a crime? And the reality is that once that happens, there is no control alt delete. There's no, hey, maybe we can change everybody's mind about what happened. The allegation is there, and it sticks with you for really forever,
Forever,
forever.
forever, because of the internet.
And so, you know, and that's the part that I think is very troubling is that, you know, when in law enforcement, we're given such a huge power, right? And the problem with it is you only have to go to a police academy for 6 months. And yet after 6 months, you could be, after you pass the post exam, you know, the peace officer standards and training exam, once you pass it, you become a deputy or, you know, or a sworn local or state agency law enforcement officer. The reality is you're given the power to essentially do anything. And I mean that in every sense of the word. It means I have the power to stop a car if it's speeding or what I perceive to be speeding or violating some criminal code. I can arrest somebody with probable cause, you know, and probable cause is such a low standard that, you know, what ends up happening is we make these arrests and then we kind of just wipe our hands of it, right? And we wait until the trial happens, if there's going to be a trial. And then when the trial happens, right, we go in and what happens with a lot of our jurors? A lot of our citizens of the United States of America believe that our government is trustworthy, that these are people that you should trust and you should believe. And so when there's an allegation made against an individual, the immediate thought in a lot of people's minds that sit on our jury is this: why would the government go through the trouble of making an arrest if this person did not do something wrong?
Right. They had to
So
have done something.
they had to have done something, right? And so, you know, especially if you got somebody who's been stacked with charges, and you know how that works, right? We
I
used to,
do.
right? We stack charges as leverage, right? They committed all these crimes, but you know what? We're going to get them on one of them. And that's the way they think. And so juries think, why would there be 10 charges if this person was completely innocent, right? Because it doesn't logically make sense. You charge somebody with 10 crimes, 10 statutes that were violated, and you're telling me that none of those are going to stick with him? No, I don't think so. Not as a juror. And you know, we're gonna say that he's done something. And so for us, right, what we're seeing is people that are charged with numerous charges, it ends up that typically they get charged with at least one of them, right? They get convicted
Right,
except
right, right.
one
And
of them.
they'll, and also, as an example, like what you're talking about, someone may be charged with first degree murder, but they'll also allow the jury to convict them of second degree murder or manslaughter as well. And
Right.
they're like, well, you know, I don't think they proved that he killed them at all. And then they're like, well, I mean, he probably did, you know, but they didn't prove it. So, okay, let's all go with manslaughter. And
Yep.
it's like, wait a minute.
Right.
If they didn't prove their case that he committed the homicide, you shouldn't be convicting for anything,
Correct.
you know. But and there's no training, and I've said this before, there's no training class to teach our young people or young adults how to sit on a jury to understand how the system works, because you know we've been there, and you know, and I just told you something that happened last week, you know, with a judge, and I'm not going to get into specifics.
Right.
But as far as I'm concerned, this judge up in Northern Colorado tipped the scale of justice. And I just, that's wrong. And
Right.
it's like, well, you can always appeal. But again, that's almost like cutting a plea bargain. Appeals, you're going to be sitting in prison, waiting out an appeal. And who's going to advocate for you to do this appeal? Because if you think you're going to do this appeal yourself from prison, you're screwed.
Right.
You know, and so it's very important that all the players in the system know their roles and they don't tip the scales of justice. How many cops, I mean, you had who's the crime analyst for CBI who skipped a lot of things, I can't remember her name, Missy,
Oh, the DNA analysts.
the DNA analyst.
Yep.
So the end justifies the means. It's like, you know, hey, I'm putting people in prison and now look at the repercussions of, did she actually, because of her actions, and she's part of the law enforcement team, the judicial system, how many innocent people are in prison because she wanted to take the easy road, and especially DNA testing, for God's sakes, if there's anything you want to make sure you're right on, I mean, if you're going to go in the courtroom and say, hey, that person matches, I mean, I know it's quite the opposite of that, but basically what they're saying is the DNA matches. And when a jury hears that, they're going to convict.
That's
And
right.
come to find out that, I know you say it backwards, it's always they can't be excluded, but you're basically saying they're a match.
Yeah.
And so, how many cops are rogue and things like that? So, who advocates for those that are falsely accused? So, like I said, I do love the opportunity to work for the defense and make sure that law enforcement, the judicial system, does it right, constitutionally correct.
Yeah, it's, and that's the troubling part, Mark, is it's also gotten to be very political, and you know how much I like politics. I hate
Yeah.
it,
Well, it
right?
shouldn't be in law enforcement.
It
The
should
judicial
not.
system
It
should
should
have
not.
nothing to do
That's
with
exactly.
politics at all.
That's
And
right.
that's not where we are today.
It's not, and so, what ends up happening is, we have elected DAs who, I think that's a mistake. I think that we need to have people that are not elected because then, they need to get reelected. And so, the idea is that we should not be nominating, electing sheriffs. We should not be, it should be an appointment. And it should be based on merit. It shouldn't be based on, hey, whether or not you're on the left side or the right side. But the problem with, I think, when you listen to people who maybe talk about you and me, and I know they don't equate you to this, but maybe they equate me to this, is that there's this liberal woke, approach because you're an advocate for the accused, and it's not that. The idea here is that what I think we're failing to understand is that in law enforcement, you're supposed to gather facts. You're supposed to just put the facts together and let a prosecutor present that case and let a jury decide whether those facts
Oh, yeah.
rise to the level, right? But what we end up doing is it becomes not based on facts, it becomes based on the type of crime, right? So if we have somebody who's been charged with, a pretty heinous crime, the immediate response that we see is that that person deserves a rotten hell. Right? Not,
Right.
hey, there's a
And that's
presumption
emotion
of
talking.
innocence. Yeah, it's not this presumption of innocence. It's this, they're guilty because of these heinous crimes that they're being accused of doing. And don't get me wrong, you and I have worked plenty of cases. I just had to tell an attorney just a few hours ago that the case is not good for their client. It's not. It's not a good case. And
Right.
so there's nothing I can do to make their case better for their client. And we come across those cases. But the problem is that it's become such an adversarial relationship that we end up having people not looking at the facts. We have prosecutors not seeking justice, it's seeking wins. We have defense
Oh,
attorneys
yeah.
that are not, you're right, they're not doing their end of the deal, which is to defend their client. And so what we have is this system that when it works great. But boy, what I can tell you, and I'm sure you're going to agree with this, is unfortunately we're seeing a lot of cases that are not about the facts. They're not
Or the
about
truth.
the truth.
Getting
Exactly.
to the truth, seeking justice.
Yep.
It's about, I'm the DA, I want to win.
Yep.
And
Because it's
when they get
about
into
winning.
that, and the whole thing again about confirmational bias, and of course, our DAs have absolute immunity, which is a huge mistake. Need to get rid of that, even for the judges, too. I mean, if you have a judge who's tipping the scale, there needs to be repercussions for individuals. Whether they're judges or district attorneys, no one should have absolute immunity.
I
Uh,
agree.
it, it's been
Everybody's
it's been a
accountable.
challenge, and I do. I always want to make, whenever I kind of knock judges or DAs, I want to say most of them are awesome. Unfortunately, the whole DA's office, they get bred into this environment of wanting the win. It's very few DAs now that are just like, well, what's the truth? What's the truth? They seem to always get defensive, and it's like, I'm not going to lose this case. Well, you should never say that. You should say, hey, I'm really going to get to the truth of this. That's what they should be saying.
I was just going to tell Mark, there was I won't go into any specifics on this case, but what's interesting is in this particular case that I have, the ballistics in the in this particular homicide did not match.
Right.
What's interesting is the media's actual print, their actual what they're saying on television is that the ballistics matched from the crime scene, but yet the science behind it said that none of it matched.
None of it
So,
matched.
right? So he's already this individual's already been convicted in the in this, you know, in the
In the
public.
media.
The media, right? The public already has this perception based on what the media has presented that the facts are that the ballistics match. When in actuality, the ballistics don't match.
Did not match.
Did not
And
match.
so that's why the jury, well, I'm, like you said, we don't want to get into specifics,
Right.
but the key is that the jury got the truth,
They did.
which is that the ballistics did not match the weapon
Right.
that he had versus the weapon that was used in the homicide.
Correct.
And but yes, the local media got it wrong, because I remember reading that article and going, wait a minute, I know this case,
Right. And how often does that happen, right? I mean, how many times have people, you know, watched a television show or listened on the radio to a particular case and they already made, you know, a determination based on what the media has presented, you know?
Right,
And
exactly.
again, right, I don't know anything of about the Diddy case. I don't know anything about these some of these the Kohlberger case, but the reality is you know, we got to look at the facts. You got to, you know, you got to base your decisions on the facts of the case, not on the political alignment of wherever you are in you know,
Right.
politically aligned.
When you pull someone over, you don't ask them if they're a Republican or a Democrat.
Right.
They're a
Right.
speeder.
That's
That's
right.
all. They're a
Right.
speeder.
Yep.
Hey, so John, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you jumping on. So
No worries.
we took a conversation, and we didn't even really talk about, us starting up. And just here real quick, I got about a minute left. We struggled. Now, I will tell you right now, our businesses are doing quite well. I'm in a really happy place with our business. We are very well sought after in the state of Colorado and other states for our consulting and our expertise. But at first, people, especially defense attorneys and public defenders, were like, wait a minute, you're retired cops. So it
Right.
took us a while. I'd say the first 3 to 4 years, the old term, like, not, I don't want to say paycheck to paycheck, but we were, there's a lot of challenges going on. But really, the last few years, I have loved working with all these attorneys. We've built relationships with a lot of attorneys that call us back with the new projects.
Sure.
Follow on business, which is the ultimate sign of success. And I love what we're doing working for the defense.
Yeah, in defense and also civil attorneys, you know, there's
Oh, yep.
and citizens, right? People that they don't
That
know
need our
what to
help.
do and they need our help. Exactly. So it's been very rewarding in that sense. And, you know, I think if we just stay the course of it's all about the facts, the truth, seeking the truth, you know, that's what makes testifying easier for us because we don't have to lie
Stating the
about it.
truth.
It's just, hey, this is what it is, you know.
Okay. So,
They don't pay me to make to say something, you know, in their
right.
favor.
Like I always say in court, they're saying, because they'll always ask you, just to wrap this up, because you got to run. They'll
Sure.
always say, oh, the defense is paying you to, to testify. And it's like, no, they're paying for my time. They're not paying me for what I'm saying. They're compensating me for my time.
Correct.
That's always true, because as experts, we're going to talk about what is the truth. So, hey, I hope everybody enjoyed our talk about all over the place, and especially the last 30 minutes with John. It always goes great when he joins me. So, I'm hoping Chuck and Julie, I'm not sure who's hosting on Wednesday, but hopefully it'll be Chuck and Julie. But hey, see you guys next time when I guest host. Have a great Monday.
See you, Mark. Thanks.